Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Amazon's recent announcement to buy Whole Foods for nearly $14 billion has revived the debate about corporate monopolies. In her recent piece in The Atlantic, today's guest, Stacey Mitchell, looks at the rise and fall of the word monopoly in American life. What happens when the system unfairly favors powerful interests? She writes that too little competition can lead to higher prices, and new evidence indicates that high levels of concentration may be to blame for a variety of problems: stagnant wages, rising inequality, and the steep drop in the number of new businesses launched every year. To understand today's monopolies, just imagine a day in the life of an everyday American. Five banks control almost half of the country's $17 trillion in assets. Walmart controls half or more of grocery spending in 40 metro areas. Four airlines dominate the skies. Six corporations control 90% of the media. And 75% of households have only one internet provider to choose from. Four major tech companies control just about every aspect of our virtual lives. That's Apple, Facebook, Google, and Amazon. Stacey Mitchell also notes that monopolies are one of the main drivers of inequality, providing profits to the wealthy, who then use those profits to lobby and distort American politics. Stacey Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. It's a nonprofit that champions and supports equitable community development. The organization is urging regulators to block Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods. Stacey is also author of Big Box Swindle: The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Hi, Stacey. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. You wrote a piece in The Atlantic that's getting a lot of attention called The Rise and Fall of the Word Monopoly in American Life. And you report that for several decades, the term was a fixture of newspaper headlines and campaign speeches, and then something changed. And we'll talk about what happened. But first of all, the debate around monopolies has been revived because of this Amazon Whole Foods deal. Why don't we just talk about what a monopoly is and how it's really changed over time?
Sure. I mean, a monopoly is a company, you know, it doesn't have to be, despite the name monopoly, which sort of sounds like it means one company, it doesn't have to be one company in a market, but it's a company that has enough power in a market that it can set the terms by which other companies can play. And that it has the power to raise prices potentially or to exclude and undermine other competitors. And we're seeing in a lot of industries evidence that companies have monopoly power, and Amazon is certainly one of them.
What strikes you today about what we're facing? It's interesting to read that five banks control about half of the country's $17 trillion assets. Two corporations make 69% of the beer that we drink. When you fly, you have about four choices. At least four airlines dominate the skies. 75% of our homes have only one internet provider. The other thing that's interesting is sometimes it feels like we have a lot of choices, but we don't know that, say, for example, 10 companies, 10 beer makers are owned by one major beer maker.
That's exactly right. It's, you know, you go to the grocery store and you're just, every aisle you walk down, you have this illusion of choice. You know, you walk down the beer aisle and you see all these different brands, but it turns out that 70% of that beer is really just two companies who market it under different labels. And increasingly are buying up even sort of what we would consider to be craft breweries and bringing those under their production as well, but leaving the same name so you wouldn't know the difference. We're seeing this across the economy. I mean, just a level of consolidation that's really unprecedented in history, or at least we haven't seen anything like this. You have to go back to the 1920s to see the last period of this kind of tight control by just a few companies.
And when you look at the investors that own the companies, you see the same thing. So 93% of Whole Foods shares, for example, are owned by investors, with a quarter owned by just three companies: Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street. And so does this apply across the board when you look at the money behind these companies? Is it the same players for the most part?
This has been one of the most interesting new developments in the research on monopoly is that this consolidation among shareholders, as you note, that a lot of companies now, like you look at the four big airlines, it turns out that their major shareholders are all the same. And so when you look down at that deeper level, we've really got the same companies or the same shareholders essentially calling the shots. And there has been research now by economists that has found that that actually makes a difference, that when there is that common shareholding, companies don't compete against each other and prices actually go up, and there are other ill effects as well. So yeah, it's, you know, it's an even deeper level of consolidation than what we can see.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Dow and DuPont won U.S. antitrust approval to merge, I'm reading from Reuters right now, on condition that the companies sell certain crop protection products and other assets. And this didn't really even get that much attention. You often hear about offers to buy, and then sometimes these deals go through without much attention.
True, and part of the problem is that the antitrust agencies, you know, the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, which is charged with keeping our, you know, keeping the economy competitive and enforcing antitrust laws, they often do that work really in the shadows, and there's not a lot of public engagement. Sometimes they will close investigations into potential monopolies without telling anyone that they're closing that investigation or why they're closing that investigation. So we've gotten sort of lulled into a situation where a lot of this enforcement is kind of left in the hands of technical experts, and there is a real lack of democratic oversight about what is happening. And of course, that's especially dangerous because, you know, we can talk about all the ways in which monopoly is detrimental to us economically, the way that it harms us not only as consumers, but harms our prospects as workers, as small business owners, the way it's driving inequality right now. But monopoly is also a political problem because these are companies that have gained control of our government. And increasingly, we live in communities where the most important decisions made about the future of our communities are not made by the people who live there, but by these distant corporations that consolidate a lot of power. And so when you see government agencies not being engaged with the public and not being transparent about what's going on, it helps to further feed this problem of just sort of the political consolidation of power and what this ultimately means to democracy.
Speaking of public agencies, the Federal Trade Commission has to review this Amazon Whole Foods acquisition before it can be completed, but Donald Trump has yet to appoint someone to chair the Federal Trade Commission.
That's right. That's right. You know, we, I think that, I mean, this proposed acquisition of Whole Foods by Amazon has gotten a lot of attention in the last week, and I think that's encouraging in a lot of ways because I do think it's a wake-up call. And one of the things it really brings to light is that we, you know, our antitrust review and our merger review process is really kind of lives in the analog age and is not well equipped. We've been very flat-footed when it comes to understanding how these new tech monopolies are tightening their grip around our economy and what the implications of that are. And so I'm hopeful that maybe this is going to start a new conversation and we may begin to rethink how we're doing things. If the regulators at the FTC look at Amazon's proposal to buy Whole Foods and in sort of the conventional way that they've looked at these kinds of deals, then it's probably going to go through. But that would really be a mistake. And what we're arguing for is that we need to really look at the kind of monopoly power that Amazon now has online and ask, how is it that Whole Foods is going to help Amazon solidify that online monopoly? And that in and of itself ought to be grounds for saying no.
What new ways would you like to see federal regulators look at these deals? As you mentioned, this is a new world. I mean, you've got Amazon controlling so much of the online market, and then Whole Foods has just over 460 stores in the United States, Canada, and the UK.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are two different kinds of answers I might give to that question. I mean, one, just looking at the Amazon Whole Foods situation narrowly, and then maybe a broader comment as well. You know, on the Amazon now has monopoly power in online commerce. They're capturing one out of every $2 that Americans spend online, and that's up from one out of every $3 just 3 years ago. So you can see where it's going. They're now the biggest seller of toys, books, apparel, and electronics of any other retailer online and off. With Alexa, their voice assistant, with Prime, they're becoming the default place that we go for everything. And they have amassed this power. It means that other companies that want to compete and sell us things online, whether it's, you know, independent brick and mortar stores that have websites, whether it's, you know, major brand names like Levi's or KitchenAid or anyone else you can think of, other retailers, other online companies, they're all finding that there is no longer any traffic out there. The people are not starting at search engines. They're starting right on Amazon. And that has meant that all those other players now have to become sellers on Amazon's platform if they want to reach the market. And that poses all sorts of conflict of interest problems. We are seeing Amazon use the data that it gathers from those transactions to undermine those other companies as competitors and also to augment its power over suppliers. So we've documented how Amazon really has this kind of detrimental monopoly power in online commerce. And what would happen if they bought Whole Foods is that they would then gain a network of stores and fresh food warehouses that they could use to rapidly become the dominant online grocer. They would also gain a lot of new data because they're pioneering ways to track us when we're inside stores and monitor what we do. And Amazon is expert at using that kind of data to impede competition in various ways. So acquiring Whole Foods, even though Amazon is a small player right now in groceries and Whole Foods itself is a small player in groceries, that acquisition is going to help solidify and expand Amazon's monopoly online. And that's really what the problem is. The challenge for regulators is that the way they've tended to look at this in the old analog model is to say, oh, well, there's, you know, what is the market? And they'll say, well, if they say the market is the grocery industry, they'll say, well, Whole Foods isn't such a big player in that overall market, and so this shouldn't concern us. But what that misses is that, you know, this idea that there's this separation now, you know, the boundaries between online and offline and between different sectors are becoming fluid, and more of our commerce is being digitally driven, and that's really what we've got to look at. And then just, you know, the bigger point about where we are from a regulatory framework is that, you know, the changes that happened in antitrust enforcement in the beginning of the 1980s, we dropped this sort of broad view that we used to have. For decades, we looked at antitrust and we said the goal of having strong monopoly policies is not just to protect consumers from high prices, but to create a level playing field where everybody could go out there and compete, that small businesses had an equal chance, a fair chance to compete, that workers were protected from monopoly employers, and that we also were protecting democracy. That was a goal of antitrust. And you know, in the 80s, we just dropped all of that, and they said, well, if you can lower prices in the short term, that's all that matters. And so that's a real big shift, and we need to turn things back.
Today we're speaking with Stacy Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, about monopolies and concentrated corporate power. What questions do you have about monopolies? They've definitely changed over the years. I mean, even if you just look at beer, it's really interesting to think about the fact that two companies make 69% of the beer we drink. Now, when you go to the store, there's a bunch of different brands. When you go to a bar, there's a bunch of different brands. But two companies own a lot of those brands. So it's not just monopoly one corporation that we're talking about anymore. Sometimes it's two, sometimes it's four in the case of airlines really dominating the skies. What questions do you have about monopolies, and how do you think the government and public officials should deal with these massive deals that we're seeing? As Stacy said, Amazon gets one of every $2 that people spend online. They have a massive footprint online. And then also, when you look offline, Amazon sold six times as much online as Walmart, Target, Best Buy, Nordstrom, Home Depot, Macy's, Kohl's, and Costco did combined. So Amazon has a major, major foothold when it comes to spending and shopping. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's an incredible fact, Stacey, that Amazon sold six times as those retailers that are already big in their own right combined. That was last year.
It really is. You know, I also find it rather stunning that Amazon sells more apparel than anybody else. What's interesting about that and alarming, I think, is that Amazon not only has very rapidly become the largest seller of clothing online or off in the country, but they're actually manufacturing a growing share of the clothing that they sell. They've created seven clothing lines in the last couple of years. They're manufacturing over 2,000 items of clothing. And one of the reasons that should concern us is that Amazon is now a kind of gatekeeper. And so what some studies have shown is that when you go to Amazon and you search for a product and you are then sort of browsing that product page and you know that carousel at the bottom that says customers who bought this also bought that, well, that's governed by an algorithm that Amazon writes. And what one study has found is that when you're in the clothing area, Amazon's actually favoring its own clothing items there. It's putting its own brand clothing in that spot, even if it's not the best match for you. So Amazon's using its power as a kind of platform, as the sort of rails that all these other companies have to ride if they want to get to market, in order to discriminate and steer consumers to its own products. You know, that wouldn't matter so much if we had a diverse and competitive online economy, but we don't. You know, we have this one giant that really dominates everything, and that therein lies the problem.
Your organization put together a massive report called Amazon's Stranglehold. You talked about how Amazon monopolizes the economy. What about jobs and wages? Your group examined Amazon's labor model and found that work inside its 190 distribution facilities resembles labor's distant past more than a promising future.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, it was really strange to do this research on this company that is so seemingly futuristic in so many ways, but to find that over and over again, it reminded us much more of the past. You know, it reminded us of the robber barons who used to control the railroads and use that power to discriminate and harm competition. And it reminded us of sort of this old way of labor where, you know, workers worked on piece rate, they were subcontractors, poorly treated, and there was no real protection. And that's what we found is the case in a lot of Amazon's warehouses. Amazon pays, we looked at 11 metro areas where they have a significant warehouse presence, and we found that it pays about 15% less on average than the going rate for warehouse work, which is already pretty low. So rather than being out ahead, they're actually pulling wages down, and they're increasingly automated. I mean, already when Amazon displaces sales at brick and mortar stores, they're actually killing off more jobs than they're creating in their warehouses. And this, you know, this isn't just Amazon, it's this whole consolidation problem in general, because there's some very powerful new economic research that's been written about by, you know, The Economist magazine and sort of all these mainstream outlets that has found a powerful link between consolidation and growing inequality. And in particular, studies that have found that the industries that have seen the most consolidation, you know, with the fewest companies taking over, those are the same industries that have seen the biggest gap between the lowest paid and the highest paid. So this is, you know, we're learning that part of what is driving our economy is this inequality, driving inequality is this consolidation. And just one more note on that front, because I think it's really important. The other thing that is, I think, so crucial about what's happening is that not only are these companies able to hold down wages for people, but they're also blocking a pathway to the middle class, and that is small business ownership. You know, we have the rate of new business formation in this country is half of what it was back in the late 1970s.
Wow.
You know, we think we're a nation of startups, but we aren't anymore.
It's half of what it was in the 70s.
Yes. It's stunning. It's one of the most, you know, you talk to economists who look at this, it's one of the most scary trend lines that they're seeing in the economy. And we've, you know, we did another paper last year called Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. And what we documented in that is a lot of sectors of the economy where small business is actually more competitive than big business by any objective measure, and yet they're shrinking. And what we found is that in those sectors, you've got giant companies that are able to use their market power to squeeze out these small competitors. Beer is a good example. I mean, we have all this consumer demand for craft beer, and it is growing. We're seeing more small-scale breweries, but those breweries are facing a harder and harder time getting shelf space in grocery stores because the big beer companies, Anheuser-Busch, has, you know, taken control of the distribution. They've bought up the distribution, or they've gone into deals with wholesalers, and they're actually saying, you put more of our beer on the shelf and we'll give you these kickbacks. Keep those small craft beers off. So it's not competitive anymore, and that really, I think, speaks to the heart of what this is about.
Well, if you own a small business, we'd love to hear from you. How have things changed for you over the past couple of decades? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Today, we are talking about monopolies and the corporate concentration of power. And let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. As I was listening to the program after I talked with your producer, it occurred to me that Jeff Bezos also owns the Washington Post. The owner of Amazon owns the Washington Post. I mean, that's incredible amount of power in addition to the fact that he has this monopoly.
Right. Thank you for that. In fact, Stacey, I was going to ask you what struck you about coverage of this deal. I did notice that when your report, Amazon Stranglehold, came out, I think it was earlier this year, it didn't get any coverage in the Washington Post. So how is this Amazon bid to buy Whole Foods being covered in the Washington Post?
Well, they have done some stories. They did do a nice story on this, I think a kind of eye-opening story on this new patent that Amazon has filed that will give it this sort of technology to track us when we're inside its stores and actually block our ability to access competitors' websites on our phones. So they have covered it some, and I continue to be hopeful that they are going to, you know, that they're going to be doing more in-depth reporting. There has been a sort of noticeable lack of stories about Amazon in general, I would say, at the Washington Post over the last year or two compared to other major outlets. But, you know, we shall see. There's a long history of rich people owning newspapers in this country, and this is another iteration of it. And, of course, it's the one that matters the most in the sense that, you know, this is the paper of record for lawmakers and people who are making policy decisions. You know, in addition to buying the Post, you know, Amazon has, and the Post is owned by Jeff Bezos as opposed to Amazon itself.
Right.
Amazon has also really upped the amount of money that they're spending on campaign contributions and lobbying. They're now spending a lot more on that kind of DC influence than, say, you know, Walmart or Apple or other big companies in their league are spending.
Well, thank you for the call, John. And I also wanted to ask you, Stacey, right before we go to break, how have monopolies affected profits and stock? The Atlantic reports that on Friday, when Amazon announced it was buying Whole Foods for more than $13 billion, an hour later, Amazon's stock rose by about 3%, adding $14 billion to its value. As The Atlantic reports, Amazon basically bought the country's sixth largest grocery store for free.
That's exactly right. And it's the opposite of what you would normally see in such deals. Usually the acquiring company's stock goes down a bit after they make an announcement like this. That's a typical pattern. So the fact that we saw Amazon go up and buy so much that the acquisition essentially was paid for in a matter of hours really is telling. You know, investors have bid up Amazon stock to a level that bears no relationship to the company's profits. I mean, Amazon is now worth two or three times what Walmart is worth, and Walmart generated like $80 billion in profits in recent years, whereas Amazon, you know, just a few billion dollars in profits. The reason for that is that investors are eyeing the future, and they see a company that is going to have such a powerful monopoly that it will generate monopoly kinds of returns for years to come. And their willingness to finance Amazon's losses for two decades now, in order to grab that kind of market share, is really part of the story of how this company has become so powerful. We're seeing this, of course, not just with Amazon, but profits across big business are at an all-time high. And there's some new research published by the Stigler Center at the University of Chicago that finds that, you know, as that revenue is going towards profits, it's not only cutting workers' wages, not only workers sort of losing out in that shift, but also investment in innovation, investment in R&D and other kinds of development have declined. So, you know, it really speaks to the health of the economy overall, and, you know, sort of remembering that the engine of innovation in our society has always been the diversity of companies, having lots of small businesses and startups and competition, and we're losing competition.
Stacy Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. It's a nonprofit that supports equitable community development, and the organization is urging regulators to block Amazon's $13.7 billion bid to buy Whole Foods. Stacy is author of Big Box Swindle, and today we're talking about monopolies and corporate power. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. A quick thank you to Walter and Margaret Hotter of Daly City for your support of KALW, keeping us public and local in local public radio. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about gerrymandering and how it shapes the U.S. electoral map. This fall, the Supreme Court will hear a case from Wisconsin, and that case could decide whether gerrymandered election maps, which favor one political party over another, violate the Constitution. This is going to be a very important case. I hope you can tune in tomorrow for that. We're also putting shows together later in the week about workplace culture and sexual harassment. Today, we are talking about monopolies and corporate power. The word monopoly is coming back. A lot of people are debating this in light of Amazon's $13.7 billion bid to buy Whole Foods. In other merger news, just last week, Dow Chemical and DuPont won U.S. antitrust approval to merge. So if you have any questions or comments about monopolies and the concentrated power of corporations, do you think about these issues when you make a purchase? In fact, sometimes it's difficult to know who owns whatever you're buying, whether it's beer or, say, organic juice, toothpaste, for example. Sometimes you just don't know who owns the company. But what we're seeing is two corporations make 69% of the beer that we drink. Four airlines dominate the skies. 75% of our homes have only one internet provider. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Jake who says, even if Amazon controls 100% of online sales, they still have to keep prices low enough to prevent competition from eating their market share. What are your thoughts on that, Stacy?
You know, we've already begun to see Amazon selectively raising prices. It's done this for books that are, you know, not the bestsellers and the sort of top books, but books by smaller publishers, less well-known authors. You know, it used to discount those heavily, and there was reporting in the New York Times that showed that those prices had actually come up. We also know that Amazon makes millions of price changes every day. More and more people are buying on Amazon in a sort of out of a kind of unthinking habit. People who belong to Prime, for example, which is now half of all U.S. households, don't actually comparison shop. They really just start right at Amazon. And this will become more and more true with the introduction of Alexa, you know, their voice assistant, which is coming, you know, on their Echo speakers and is now being installed in a lot of different products. People are beginning to shop in ways where they're not doing price comparisons. Amazon takes advantage of that. Another report in the New York Times just recently found that prices vary by as much as 170% on a set of items. So depending on what time of day you buy it, and also maybe who you are when you buy it, you may be paying a substantially higher price. So I think we're a little bit being a little bit naive if we imagine that Amazon's enormous information advantage over all of us isn't going to be used in ways against us when it comes to price. The other thing, just quickly to the callers or the emailers' question, is that, you know, part of the reason we've been a little bit lax about Amazon getting to this point is you sort of assume that online is just as, you know, anybody, you know, a company could come along and at any moment a great startup could come along and change everything. And we've made that assumption because we've experienced that in the past. You know, you think about Facebook or Google or Amazon, you know, they came along and they upended everything. So why can't that happen? Well, if you think about it, that actually hasn't happened in quite a long time. And some people are pointing to these tech monopolies, and in particular to the fact that whenever there's an upstart competitor now, Amazon, and this is true of Facebook and Google, just go out and buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So when diapers came along, you know, diapers.com really had this different model. They were doing great business. They were outrunning Amazon on diaper sales. Amazon responded by marking, you know, pricing its diapers well below cost. Diapers.com had to match that, but as a smaller company, eventually it was just bleeding red ink everywhere, and the board decided that they had to sell to Amazon, and now they're part of Amazon. So I'm not really convinced that as Amazon gains in this dominance, and particularly as it starts, you know, it's building out more and more warehousing and shipping logistics infrastructure, it is actually possible anymore for another company to come along and actually challenge them and succeed.
A lot of people don't know what goes on behind the scenes. When you talked about when you go online at a different time of the day, you might be charged a different price, for example. Can you tell us about a few more of these tactics that these massive corporations are using that people might not know about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a great book by out recently by Harvard University. It's published by Harvard University Press by two antitrust legal scholars. It's called Virtual Competition, and it's really about the ways in which the online environment often creates things that are sort of signals that there's competition, but in fact, just the opposite is occurring. The ability to adjust prices is a big part of this. I think it's hard to sort of wrap our minds around how much data Amazon has about all of us. But Amazon watches what we're doing when we're online, how long our browser hovers over a particular product, whether we buy it or not, what we browse for. It monitors what we're doing if we're still logged on and we're on other websites. It's monitoring that. It monitors what we watch on Prime. And, of course, it marries that data to all sorts of data that it gets about us, you know, buying data on the, you know, out on the market about our demographics, our income, and who knows what else, where we live. And what companies are beginning to figure out how to do is then to use algorithms and machine learning to identify the kinds of people, what your reserve price is. You know, what is, you know, are you the kind of shopper who's going to be, what might you pay? Or what kind of situation are you in? Do you have brick and mortar competitors for a particular product in your zip code or not? And if you don't, maybe you're going to see a higher price. And those price adjustments are happening right now. We haven't seen direct evidence of discrimination in the sense of one person getting a different price over another, but it's become kind of impossible to actually track that because Amazon makes millions and millions of price adjustments every day. I mean, prices are changing constantly, so at any given second, the price that you're seeing is a product of these algorithms, And it may be, you know, it may be dependent on you, and you may actually be seeing a higher price. So, you know, there's all this stuff that goes on behind the scenes. And, you know, I've talked mostly about how Amazon uses that information strategically against consumers, but it's also important to note that they use it strategically against their competitors, and particularly the other companies that now have to use Amazon's platform and are actually selling on Amazon's site. There's all kinds of ways in which Amazon is mining what those companies are doing, tracking them, and then going, you know, specifically going after the most lucrative parts of their business.
Stacey Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and we're talking today about the rise of monopolies and concentrated power. In about 5 minutes, we'll hear from Representative Ro Khanna, a freshman member of Congress representing Silicon Valley, and he's concerned that this Amazon Whole Foods merger will put pressure on wages and hurt local grocery stores. So if you have a question for Representative Khanna, we'd love to hear from you. He'll be on in just a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Kolya in San Francisco. Hi, Kolya. Welcome to the show.
Yes. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
I haven't called in to a talk program since Ray Talley Farrell KGL.
Oh, well, I'm glad,
years
glad
ago.
You called.
Yeah, so I am a first-time caller, and a couple of issues here. One thing is about General Motors. This is a little bit of history. I think in the 30s to the 50s or 60s, you know, they had the Sherman Antitrust Act passed because of this, because they were purchasing, you know, motor car companies right and left, like Chrysler, like Chevrolet, Buick, and Cadillac. These were originally independent companies, and they actually were trying to buy up the whole market. And, you know, that's why they're named General Motors. So that's something I want to throw out. And plus the fact that I know most people don't like the guy, but old Karl Marx, you know, about 150 years ago or so, you know, in this critique, he mentioned something about this at that time. The problem with capitalism is you get these corporations, they all buy each other out, and they become one great big monopoly, and it's almost like a state-run, you know, system. So I kind of wanted to throw that out there and have, you know, people comment about that if possible.
All right. Well, what about that, Stacey? There's an argument that these monopolies are unavoidable in this capitalist system, which focuses on maximizing profits. And, we also live in a shareholder economy now.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I would take a slightly inverse view in the sense that, you know, part of the reason when we were sort of going up against the Soviet Union, and part of the reason their economy didn't work very well and that a lot of Americans found it, their approach kind of distasteful, is because it was this highly centralized economy where decisions about who got to do what kind of job you got to have, and what was manufactured and produced and how it was distributed were all made from centrally by Moscow, right? And we are now moving exactly in that same direction. It won't be our government that's making those decisions. Instead, it will be Wall Street and, you know, a handful of giant companies. But that's really, you know, we've talked, you know, a lot about prices and consumer impacts, but at the end of the day, it's really about power and about the idea of living in a country where we have liberty, where we have some freedom as people, as producers of value, as small business owners, as workers, not to have our lives governed by these all-powerful entities that are, you know, that have centralized so much control. So I really think that the problem isn't so much with capitalism per se. You know, competition and small-scale, you know, free market economics, when it's grounded within communities and when it's grounded within a set of social values and when it's governed by public policies that protect the public interest, and where, you know, power isn't allowed to be central, you know, private power isn't allowed to be centralized and to the degree that we're seeing it. In that kind of context, I think, you know, the free exchange of goods works really wonderfully, but that's not what we have right now. We have this sort of corporate capitalism married to to a government that is really enabling it, and then that's the problem.
Well, Kalia, thank you for calling, and I hope you call us again soon. Speaking to your point there, Stacey, about freedom, in your Atlantic piece, you point out that at the Democratic Party's National Convention in 1936, Franklin Roosevelt devoted much of his speech to the problem of what he called industrial dictatorship. He said that a small group of powerful corporations and banks had concentrated into their own hands in almost complete control, and Americans were no longer free, and throughout the nation, opportunity was limited by monopoly. But we don't hear many politicians talk like that in today's time.
Fortunately, there are a few that are beginning to talk that way. You know, Senator Elizabeth Warren gave a terrific speech on monopoly last year. Senator Klobuchar from Minnesota talked about concentration. We've heard some from Republicans as well on this issue. And, you know, your guest here for the rest of the show, U.S. Representative Khanna, has been really outspoken. And I think, you know, in the tradition of not only FDR, but Truman and Eisenhower, you know, he has been really speaking on the Amazon merger in terms of what it means to democracy, to community, and to our society.
And we'll be joined by Representative Khanna in just a couple minutes. Let's go next to Gabriella in San Francisco. Hi, Gabriella. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Gabriella. You know each other.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for calling in.
Well, Rose, you know, we have to say this matter in our own hand. Why do we have to buy a book from Amazon? Why don't we go to Green Apple? If they don't have a book, you order it in 2 days, you get it. If you wait for the company, they are not going to change. They are there to make money. We do anything it takes for them to make money. But we can change it. Don't buy anything from Amazon. That's it. What do you think about that?
Well, I was actually thinking about this over the weekend because I was in Davis and we had a choice between Whole Foods and the local co-op. What about this, Stacey? I mean, I see people in stores taking photos of different products to see how much they are online. I mean, you hear this from booksellers. You've heard this for years from booksellers. But what about that? Trying to get citizens to make different choices, and how much of a difference does that actually make?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, there has been this real outpouring of public interest in supporting, you know, small-scale producers, local food, craft beer, independent bookstores. You know, we've seen a growing number of new independent bookstores in the last 2 years, you know, small but promising thing that's happening. We've had some new, you know, co-ops, food co-ops, and independent grocers have made a little bit of a comeback in some places. So there is this real consumer, you know, impulse, which is great, and we really encourage it. But I will say, and I actually did a TEDx talk on this a few years ago called Why We Can't Shop Our Way to a Better Economy, which is that, you know, I think we are mistaken if we think that that's going to be enough, because what we miss is all the ways in which public policy is, in effect, tilting the playing field. And at ILSR, we've done a lot of work documenting that. You know, just to give you a few examples, you know, Amazon has picked up over $1 billion in subsidies from local governments to help finance the construction of its warehouses over the last few years. For about 20 years, Amazon benefited heavily from not having to collect sales tax, which was an enormous competitive advantage. The fact that we don't prosecute our antitrust laws. And I could go on. There are all kinds of examples of how public policy favors big banks and big corporations. And so I think, you know, if, as consumers, as much as we try to direct our dollars in the right way, we don't always have an option. And we're also up against these bigger structures that are working against us. And I think our real power lies not as consumers, but as citizens. And that's really this whole buy local movement. We've got to transform it from being a consumer movement into being a movement of citizens that demands new policies, and particularly demands anti-monopoly policies.
As you report in your Atlantic piece, since Ronald Reagan took office, corporate concentration has increased dramatically. So since then, have you seen politicians truly tackle this issue?
Well, as I said, we are seeing more just in the last couple of years speak out about it. You know, the fact that monopoly was in the Democratic Party platform form for the first time in 25 years this last year was a big breakthrough. I mean, You know, Reagan led the changes of our anti-monopoly policies. You know, he didn't change the laws. What he did was change how they're interpreted by the regulatory agencies. So the laws are still there, and we need to change their interpretation back. But, you know, it wasn't just Reagan, and it wasn't just Republicans.
Right.
You know, the Democratic Party really helped out a lot, especially in the 1990s under Clinton. We saw the you know, we allowed big banks to get really big. We let the media consolidate and so on. That is what the history. But the good news is there are more and more people talking about this. We're seeing more and more. You know, we're seeing the word monopoly show up in the news in a way that wasn't true just a few years ago, and so that's really encouraging.
Stacy Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Today we're talking about monopolies and the concentration of corporate power. And now I would like to welcome Representative Ro Khanna to the show. Representative Khanna is a freshman member of Congress representing California's 17th Congressional District, which is in the heart of Silicon Valley. He's vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and he says he's concerned that the Amazon-Whole Foods merger will put pressure on wages. Hi, Representative Khanna. Welcome to the show.
Great to be on.
Great to have you. So you're one of the few politicians that's actually getting a lot of attention over this merger. What are your main concerns?
Well, my main concern is that we scrutinize these mergers and that we not just default to consumer price as the metric, but that we look at the entire impact that the merger is going to have on wages, on jobs, on local communities, on innovation, on other businesses. And this has been the tradition from Brandeis, who interpreted the Sherman Act, and then, of course, when we got the Clinton Act, and it was Roosevelt's view in 1938 in his statement to Congress that the consolidation of economic power puts downward pressure on workers' wages, and it also hurts innovation. And we got away from that with Robert Bork's antitrust paradox, where it became simply about consumer price and short-term consumer price. I believe we need a reorientation of antitrust policy in this country.
What would that look like?
Well, it would be a comprehensive look at these types of mergers and consolidation. Courts would ask, and executive branch would ask, does this consolidation on balance help American workers and wages? Does it help the local communities, or is it going to lead to further decline of small businesses? Does it help innovation? And, of course, does it help consumer prices? And does it help in creating jobs, or does it destroy jobs? And when we look at the balance of factors, consumer prices should be one of those factors, both the short-term consumer price and also long-term consumer price, but it should be a comprehensive look at what this is doing to small businesses and jobs and wages. And right now we only have a focus since Robert Bork on consumer prices.
How do you see this playing out under this current administration? The Federal Trade Commission has to review this acquisition before it's completed, but Donald Trump has yet to appoint someone to head the FTC.
Well, I'm concerned. I mean, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump was very concerned about monopolies and about economic concentration because he knew it would be something that many of his voters were concerned about. But the hope is that he will actually live up to those campaign promises and have a review. No one is saying that he should prejudge the matter, but everyone should be for the FTC and the Justice Department looking into this. Anytime you have Wall Street reacting the way it did, $15 billion of market value changing, obviously you're having a dramatic impact on the economy, and it should be reviewed.
Representative Khanna, you represent the 17th Congressional District, which is the heart of Silicon Valley. I mean, we're talking about Whole Foods, but also there's so many big box stores in your district and in the Bay Area, and they've had a major impact on local businesses. As you know, because you speak out on this a lot, people are having a really hard time making ends meet, making these low wages. A lot of them do not have benefits. How do you think the Dems should tackle these issues?
Well, I think our party has to be clearly on the side of job creation and higher wages, that message needs to really get out, and we need to have a platform on that. And that means several things. It means making sure that tax policy is favored not just to an investor and speculator class, but that the tax relief is going to the working class and the middle class that's going to spend the money and actually help consumer demand, create jobs, grow the economy. That's why Sherrod Brown and I are introducing a $1 trillion wage raise through the expansion of the earned income tax credit and arguing that that's a far better approach than the massive tax cuts to the speculators that Trump is proposing. We need federal innovation clusters across this country. There's no reason that we shouldn't be investing in research and development like the National Institute of Health, the National Science Foundation, but putting those federal jobs, those federal innovation jobs, not just in the Beltway, but in communities that need that innovation and need those new jobs. And then we need to stand up against the economic concentration in industries, because in many cases it's hurting consumers, but it's also giving these large conglomerates extraordinary leverage over workers and a downward pressure on worker wages, especially with declining unionization. And finally, we need to encourage both public and private investment into communities that have been deindustrialized, figuring out how we make sure that companies aren't putting that investment offshore or avoiding taxes here, but are investing in communities where we could create jobs.
Stacy, as you said, it's great to buy local, to go to co-ops, for example, but at the end of the day, we need to see policy changes to truly tackle these issues. What's near the top of your list?
Well, we talked about anti-monopoly policy, but I would also add we need to look at the ways in which our tax structures give basically the largest businesses the ability to avoid a lot of tax obligations, while small businesses actually pay a higher effective tax rate. We need to make sure that workers have the kind of bargaining power that they deserve to have. We need to look at things at the local and state level as well, you know, the ways that our economic development and land use policies often favor the biggest businesses. And we also, most importantly, perhaps, need to reform the banking system, because the consolidation in Wall Street is actually starving small businesses and companies that could create jobs. It's starving them of the kind of capital that they need, because Wall Street's doing its own thing with all of our assets. And the kinds of community banks and credit unions that do most of that job-creating lending, you know, have been swallowed up or rapidly disappearing right now. And that should be a real wake-up call.
Stacy Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. They are urging regulators to block Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods. Representative Ro Khanna, are you also urging regulators to block this acquisition?
Well, I'm urging them to look into it. I don't want to prejudge the conclusion. That's not the job of Congress. But what I do think they should do is definitely start a review of it, and that there's no excuse for the Justice Department and the FTC not to review the merger and to review it under a broad framework of impact. And then I have trust in the civil servants to be able to come to a determination.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back for the full hour so you can also take questions from listeners.
I would love to do that.
Thank you. Representative Khanna represents California's 17th Congressional District, which is in the heart of Silicon Valley. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for joining us, Stacy.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about gerrymandering and how it shapes the U.S. electoral map. This fall, the Supreme Court will hear a case from Wisconsin, and it could decide whether gerrymandered maps, which favor one political party over another, violates the Constitution. That's coming up tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Thanks to Malihe Razazan and Sana Salim for producing today's show. Kevin Vans is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.